The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 13/February 20, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red. There's no inner white border today because the background of the image, the featured image, is in white. Time, in large print and large block lettering, is superimposed in gray upon that white background, which features a collage of people and places, white people, black people, other people of color, upside-down tulips, right-side-up roses. It's a collage. There's an American flag, but not in color, in sepia tones of darker grays and paler tans. The photograph of the U.S. Capitol building is set askew in one corner, and it's a collage, and parts of it are quite bright with blue and white and yellow coloration. We'll begin then with the article entitled "The Brief: Trump's 2024 Test" by Philip Elliott, Salem, New Hampshire. There is a photo here of former President Donald Trump disembarking an airplane. He's walking down the steps outside, presumably Air Force One. Blue sky in the background, and he is also wearing a blue overcoat. We can see the white collar of his shirt and a red tie. By the time former President Donald Trump left a Salem, New Hampshire high school auditorium January 28, his return to the campaign trail after an unusually sleepy start to his 2024 campaign, he had ricocheted off many of his standbys, indulging conspiracy theories, nursing conservatives' fears about race and gender, and offering an alternative reality to his successor's record. The hour-long diatribe suggested President Joe Biden should have thrown his son Hunter under the bus, that members of the Taliban did not fight at night because they lack binoculars, and that wind turbines knock planes out of the sky. For a fragile front runner facing criticism over the shaky opening to his latest bid for the White House, Trump's initial showing did little to calm the skittishness among Republicans and some former supporters that the candidate himself acknowledged. They said he's not campaigning, maybe he's lost a step, Trump said, mocking his critics. I am more angry now, and I am more committed now than ever. Maybe, but words, even hyper-exaggerated and errant ones, are not deeds. Trump's drop by with the New Hampshire GOP's annual meeting did not prove his critics wrong. Nor did his next stop in South Carolina, where he unfurled a pack of high-wattage supporters at the state capitol, but offered no more steady or reassuring a performance. Together we will complete the unfinished business of making America great again, Trump said in Columbia, South Carolina. Yet Trump is not starting as a blank slate national candidate grounded in a slogan. His image is pretty well baked at this point. A meager 5% of Americans, according to a CNN poll conducted January 19 to 22, said they do not have an opinion about the lone president who was impeached twice and whose actions after the 2020 election culminated in a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Trump may want to run as a traditional candidate with the strong support befitting a former president, but that is not in the cards for him. For his numerous potential Republican challengers, Trump's showing at his first campaign stops should not have spooked anyone from the race. Sure, Trump can still butcher political red meat with the best of them. He can slag his foes without a flinch, call the modern Democratic Party a tribe of socialists, Marxists, and communists, and disparage Black Lives Matter demonstrators as criminals. But mentions of Hunter Biden's laptop seemed to land with a thud, and members of the audience appeared to go numb when crooked Hillary Clinton came up. His boasts about being called Your Excellency now just seem sad, a relic of a bygone time. In appealing to voters to take back his spot in the Oval Office, Trump has a rich reservoir of material to mine. If you strip away his crass rhetoric, his agenda as president gave conservatives a whole lot of their wish list that has been incomplete since the Reagan era. Trump picked up on the public's discontent with the border crisis, the economic disparities incumbent with globalization, the rampant drug addiction crisis in the U.S. In turn, he reshaped the modern GOP to fit his needs. It is just not clear the current party actually wants him as its leader anymore. Ex-presidents leave office with some unique stories, and Trump is no exception. Amid a salvage yard of anti-trans exclusionary ideas and a pitch for the direct election of school principals, Trump told the crowd in New Hampshire the old tale of landing in another country and being shocked that Air Force One had to dim its lights and draw the shades for security precautions. He then questioned why he hadn't given himself a medal for courage. Trump talked about his negotiating sessions with the Taliban and the five telephone operators who stood by to help him place calls. Corporate clients may pay top dollar to hear such anecdotes on the lecture circuit. Most former presidents command six figures for an afternoon in a convention center, and Trump's time in D.C. is certainly ripe for story time, which, if you listen carefully to the activists in the audience at Republican events, especially after January 6, 2021, is where many in the party would prefer Trump spend his days. For many, the late-night tweets, the policy by vamp, and the bully-to-victory approach of the Trump show has worn thin. I liked President Trump's policies, Michael Loftus says in the school hallway, but he's so divisive. The 67-year-old retiree from Newport continues, "Going forward, we need someone who's not so controversial." That, no matter how much sandpaper Trump brings to his new workshop, will never be the case, which is why Senator Lindsey Graham, appearing with Trump in South Carolina, took direct aim at that criticism. "How many times have you heard, 'We like Trump policies, but we want somebody new'? There are no Trump policies without Donald Trump. Unsaid, there may be no Republican Party either, or at least not one modern historians recognize." The next page features a half-page photograph of the backs of two people. They appear to both be female, but it's not necessarily true. Both have long black hair. One is bound in a twisty tie to hold it into a ponytail. That particular person is wearing a tan jacket. With his or her arm around the second person, who's wearing a beige jacket, whose arm does not extend all the way around the shoulders of the other, but is landing midway on the back. "Fresh grief" is the caption, which continues, "Mourners comfort one another at a vigil January 2 for victims of the previous day's mass shooting in Monterey Park, California." After a Lunar New Year celebration, at least 11 people were killed and 9 injured in the Chinese-American suburb when a gunman opened fire at the Star Ballroom dance studio. The shooter was disarmed by a civilian at a second dance hall. Headlining the bulletin, Biden's promised Abrams tanks won't arrive in Ukraine for months. This is by W.J. Hennigan. President Joe Biden announced January 25 the U.S. will provide 31 American-made M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. After weeks of debate among administration policymakers and their European counterparts, the tanks are part of a long-term plan to strengthen the Ukrainian army with advanced weaponry to fight invading Russian forces, which occupy much of eastern and southern Ukraine. The policy turnaround is the latest sign the White House expects the conflict in Ukraine to last for many months and is prepared to support Kyiv for its duration. Battle tanks. The $400 million package includes funding for the Abrams tanks, ammunition rounds, support vehicles, and other equipment. The Abrams tank weighs more than 60 tons with a 120-millimeter cannon that can hit targets a mile away. At around 45 miles per hour, it is faster than older tanks and has specialized armor plating designed to withstand direct hits with anti-tank weapons. The Allies' response, the American move, was coordinated with European allies. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced his nation will provide 14 Leopard 2 battle tanks after intense negotiations with the U.S. and NATO partners. Scholz had privately insisted Washington provide U.S. tanks first, according to U.S. officials. The long wait. The U.S. tanks and other equipment will be procured from private contractors, not directly from the U.S. military, and are not expected to have an immediate impact on the fighting in Ukraine. We are talking months as opposed to weeks, a senior administration official said. The Ukrainian troops' Abrams training will take place outside Ukraine, officials said, but they would not say whether it will be held in the U.S. Good question. Why are groceries so expensive now? By Nick Popley or Popley. Bridget Moore, a 40-year-old mother of five from Lake Park, Georgia, has noticed her family's grocery bill is much higher these days, way over her $200 weekly budget. To keep her finances under control, she has had to buy less and get more selective in her shopping for family meals. I have not had to work since 2009, and now with five kids, it's becoming more and more difficult to afford basic necessities, she says. I did not expect to be in this situation, and it is a struggle to make ends meet. Although overall inflation is starting to cool, shoppers, like Moore, have not seen much relief. Grocery prices were up 11.8% in December, compared with those a year earlier. Grocery inflation declined from November to December, but prices have been rising sharply since early 2021. Nearly every food group costs more than it did a year ago. Grade A eggs are up 138%, margarine up 43.8%, butter sticks 38.5%, all-purpose flour up 34.5%, spaghetti and macaroni up 31.3%, according to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, data. Many shoppers who Time spoke with are struggling to keep up and asking when it will end. Their stories paint a picture of the trade-offs and difficult decisions families across the nation are facing to afford everyday pantry items. For many, the frustration is starting to boil over. I'm not happy with the state of the U.S. economy right now, says Moore. I am worried about how I will provide for my family, and it is difficult to see a way out. I hope it will get better, but with the current economic state, it is hard to say. We should not be struggling at this stage in life, and we were not before. The most noticeable price increase for most people is in eggs. A dozen grade A eggs cost, on average, $4.25 in December, making it the grocery staple with the largest year-over-year price increase. Cage-free or organic egg prices are far higher still. This is largely attributed to the ongoing avian bird flu epidemic, by which nearly 58 million birds had been infected as of January 6, the deadliest outbreak in U.S. history. Chicken meat prices have increased nearly 11% in the past year for the same reason. This is the largest animal emergency that U.S. Department of Agriculture has ever faced in this country, says Gino Lorenzoni, assistant professor of poultry science and avian health at Penn State University. And it does not look like it's going to stop anytime soon. The cost of butter has also skyrocketed over the past year. 1 pound of butter sticks is now $4.81 on average. Dairy farmers say extreme heat and smaller cow herds, the result of pandemic financial struggles, are the main reasons behind the price increase. Higher energy and fertilizer costs are also contributing to rising dairy prices. Fresh fruits and vegetables have also seen substantial price increases, though lettuce most of all, increasing 25% in the past 12 months. The culprits are dry weather conditions and an insect-borne virus that damaged crops in California's Salinas Valley, where much of the country's lettuce is grown in the winter months. Analysts say there's no straight answer on when grocery prices will stabilize. That is largely because a complex list of factors is responsible for the price hikes, including higher post-pandemic demand, ongoing supply chain shortages, geopolitical events like the war in Ukraine, and unstable weather patterns. But there may be reason for guarded optimism, even if prices might never go back to pre-pandemic levels. Shipping costs are declining, and Americans are purchasing less as they feel the pinch of inflation. Tom Bailey, senior analyst of consumer foods with Rabobank, predicts prices will soften up early this year. However, he cautions, if the last 24 months have told us anything, do not ever assume that things cannot change or get away from us. Here is the milestones page with six entries. Resigned, Jacinda Ardern. That's A-R-D-E-R-N. And I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Compassionate trailblazer. There's a photo of her. It's a woman, light-skinned with brownish-red hair that falls quite far down from her shoulders. She's wearing spiky-looking earrings. She's smiling as she's apparently being interviewed, because a lot of woolly-looking microphone covers are pointed toward her. She's standing against a backdrop of a tree with blurry green leaves and blurry brown branches and a blurry blue and white sky. Nearly 6 years after being sworn in as New Zealand's youngest ever Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern announced her resignation January 19. Amid declining Labour Party poll numbers and a divided political legacy. The 42-year-old had ruled out the prospect of seeking re-election in the fall, citing a sensation familiar to people the world over, burnout, after leading the nation of 5 million people through major events such as the COVID-19 pandemic. The Liberal leader became a household name after her swift and compassionate response to the March 2019 Christchurch mosque shootings, which left 51 people dead. That empathy was on display again in December of that year when Ardern hugged first responders after a volcano erupted on Huacari, White Island, killing 22 people. She also qualified as a role model to countless women when she followed in the footsteps of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto by giving birth while in office. Leading with her humanity at one point made Ardern the most popular New Zealand leader in a century, according to a May 2020 News Hub Reed Research poll, and produced a level of international favor dubbed Jacinda Mania. But it may also be one reason she decided to leave. After going on 6 years of some big challenges, I am human, she told reporters at a news conference in Wellington, New Zealand's capital, to announce her resignation. Politicians are human. We give all that we can for as long as we can, and then it's time. After outlining what she called a fulfilling yet challenging 5.5 years leading the South Pacific nation, Ardern concluded, I hope I leave New Zealanders with a belief that you can be kind but strong, empathetic but decisive, optimistic but focused, and that you can be your own kind of leader, one who knows when it's time to go. That article was written by Armani Syed. Delivered, we're still in milestones here, the 1,574th and last Boeing 747 jumbo jet, January 31, a totem of aviation glamour that has been gradually replaced by more fuel-efficient models. Announced the resignation of White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, January 27. Klain will be succeeded by former Obama administration official Jeff Zients. One, that's W-O-N, tennis star Novak Djokovic's 10th Australian Open, and a record-tying 22nd Grand Slam, January 29, after defeating Stefanos Tsitsipas. Died, Candy executive Ira Bourne, father of Peeps. I just saw some of those in the grocery store. Age 98, January 29. And music icon David Crosby at age 81, January 18. Now, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have one more. There's a photo here, apparently, of David Crosby, my goodness, in earlier days. Long hair. It's a black and white photo. Long hair. A long mustache. A striped, horizontally striped shirt. And he's holding a beautiful guitar. And finally, observed. So this makes the seventh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, seventh milestone. A rare sight, the Green Comet. This is by Jeffrey Kluger. When the object now known as Comet C2022E3ZTF last approached Earth 50,000 years ago, Ice Age mastodons and woolly mammoths roamed the planet. This time, stargazers were ready to spot it. February 1 and 2, the ghostly comet appeared again, visible as a bright green smudge in the northern hemisphere's skies. The modern-day astronomers at the Palomar Observatory, credited with its discovery last year, knew they had bagged something special. The comet comes from the distant Oort cloud, a distant sphere of similar objects that surrounds the solar system. Uncharacteristically, it has two tails, one made of dust and ice, the second of ionized carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen. And its striking brightness and color, the green glow, a result of diatomic carbon reacting with solar wind, says NASA researcher Bryce Bolin, is a maybe once every few decades or so event. The comet passed the Little Dipper's handle before resuming its long, looping transit through the solar system, not to return to us for another 50 millennia. The brief news, climate, a snowless future foretold on Europe's tawny slopes. Photos here, two, each of them about a quarter of a page, both in color. A closed chairlift at Campitello Matisse Ski Hill in San Massimo, Italy, January 7. The two photos depict what would look like the U.S. Southwest, with a little bit of snow filling the ditches and crevices, but the snow lift is silent because, or the ski lift is silent because those mountains are tan, not white, except for the little trenches of snow. Aaron Baker writes, when fellow skiers sent Amadeo Real photos of churned mud and grassy slopes at their French and Swiss ski resorts in January, he shuddered in sympathy but felt no sense of foreboding. As president of the Cortina d'Ampezzo's historic Sci Club 18, now that may be ski, SCI Club 18, he's confident Italy's premier ski resort in the Dolomites is pretty much immune to the no-snow apocalypse that emptied out Europe's prime ski destinations over the winter holidays. After all, most European resorts are 9,000 to 1,000 meters, 2,952 to 3,280 feet above sea level. Cortina d'Ampezzo starts at 1,600 meters, 5,249 feet, and ascends to 2,362 meters, 7,749 feet. Even if the lower slopes get a little slushy from above average temperatures, as they did in mid-January, well, there's always manufactured snow. After 5 days of low temperatures and steady efforts by the resort's snow cannons, the slopes were back in perfect condition, says Real. In February 2026, Cortina d'Ampezzo will host Winter Olympics downhill events, and Real is confident there will be plenty of snow, man-made or natural, and enough cold weather to make it stick. But artificial snow is only a stopgap solution, and an expensive one at that. Snow cannons work only at freezing temperatures or below. The only thing we're scared of is having 1 or 2 months of hot weather, he says, which is unlikely at the resort's elevation, at least for the near future. Over the winter holidays, though, most of Europe's resorts got a taste of that much warmer future. The Swiss resort of Gstaad ended up flying in snow by helicopter from elsewhere in Switzerland when temperatures hit 20 degrees centigrade, 68 Fahrenheit, in early January. It is not the first time Europe's ski resorts have been without snow, but it's the first time snow cannons, at least since they were first deployed in the 80s, could not make up for the shortfall because of high temperatures. This drove home the reality of winter without snow to resorts and skiers alike. Winter sports have become a major economic engine for alpine villages that have pinned their fortunes on regular snow and the skiers who seek it out every year. Spending hundreds of dollars a day on lift fees, hotels, restaurants, and equipment rentals. When there's no snow, there are no tourists and no income. Rolando Galli says his ski lift operation in the Italian Apennines resort of Abetone is down 2 million euro. $2.15 million compared with this time last year because of a lack of snow this season. For the area as a whole, he estimates it comes to about 10 million euro, $10.7 million in lost lodging, dining, and shopping revenues. While temperatures went back down below freezing in most of Europe's alpine regions in late January, the climate trajectory suggests muddy ski slopes will become a regular part of the future. Already the region has averaged a 2-degree centigrade increase in temperatures since pre-industrial times, compared with the globe's 1.2 degrees centigrade. That does not mean there will not be any snow. In fact, there could be increased periods of excessive snow, interspersed with bouts of rain or even hot days, extreme weather variations being as much an effect of climate change as increasing average temperatures. But that does not bode well for businesses like ski resorts that depend on reliable conditions. Even if it dumps snow for the rest of the season, Galli says, there's no way to make up for this year's lost income. He's already diversified his business model by running lifts in the summer for hikers and vacationers, which helps, but for winter there are not many options. He tried running the lifts even without snow this year, but not many tourists were willing to brave fog and rain for little more than a glimpse of the end of their noses by the time they reached the top of the mountain. It is not like climate change means warm weather and nice views at 1,500 meters above sea level in December, he says. Until it does, the only solution for saving the industry, he says, is to use artificial snow as much as possible to help people ski through the winter. Resorts farther south may not even be able to bet on man-made snow in years to come. Snow cannons at Campitello Matisse, one of the largest and most popular ski resorts in central southern Italy, were paralyzed in January because of persistent high temperatures. There at least would be skiers pivoted to more typical summertime activities like quad bikes and horse riding. Real in Cortina d'Ampezzo says Italy's northern resorts will be spared that fate, at least in the short term. We all know global warming is a serious thing, but for the future of skiing in Cortina, I do not think there's any problem, especially with artificial snow. Longer term, it is not so clear. A 2022 study published in the journal Current Issues in Tourism predicted that of the 21 cities, including Cortina d'Ampezzo, that have hosted the Winter Olympics since 1924, only a handful will reliably offer safe and fair conditions for competition by mid-century under current scenarios for greenhouse gas emissions. Even under a low-emission scenario in line with goals of the Paris Agreement to keep warming below 1.5 degrees centigrade since the pre-industrial area, Cortina d'Ampezzo is rated only marginal for downhill events by the 2050s. Without emission reductions, it is rated unacceptable. Out of all previous hosts, only Sapporo in Japan is considered a reliable bet for the 2078 or 2082 games under either emission scenario. Last year, the International Olympic Committee held off naming a host for the 2030 Winter Olympics, saying it's now considering rotating the event among several hosts as a response to the impact of climate change. And organizers of the World Cup Skiing Championships were forced to cancel this year's men's downhill and giant slalom events in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Germany, for lack of snow and a not favorable weather forecast for the scheduled January 28-29 dates. Italians are taking note. Take off the blinders. The future of skiing does not exist, and those who work in tourism must accept it, screamed a January 12 headline in the Italian online newspaper L'Inchiesta, pointing to pessimistic studies predicting the end of skiing in the Dolomites by as soon as 2036. Marco Bussona, president of Italy's Union of Mountain Communities, told the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera it was vital for winter sports meccas to start investing in summertime activities. We need to reflect on what mountains mean today in the light of climate change. While no one's writing off winter sports just yet, a fuller embrace of summertime options is probably a good business strategy. In addition to running lifts and operating mountain lodges in the summertime, Galli, who's president of the Abatona Tourist Board and a board member of Italy's National Ski Lifts Association, suggests the government and mountain communities invest in reservoirs. In winter, they can provide water for the increased use of snow cannons, and in summer, they could become tourist destinations for fishing, boating, and sightseeing. And in anticipation of another symptom of a changing climate, they can also provide water to combat bushfires. Climate change is something we have to face, he says. We cannot just put our heads in the ground and ignore it. Here's the page that features 9 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. Today focuses on Representative Ruben Gallego, Arizona Democrat, serving his 5th term in Congress, on challenging Kyrsten Sinema, his breaking point and political labels. There's a photo here of a young-looking man with plenty of hair combed off to the side of his forehead. It's a black-and-white photo, so I'm guessing the hair is brown. His eyes are without discernible color, since it's a black and white photo. He has neatly trimmed facial hair, also I'm guessing either brown and blonde or brown and gray mixed. He's wearing a dark colored jacket, a white shirt, and a dark colored tie. We have here just a thumbnail portrait of his head and shoulders. Questions now. This is a question-answer format. What are your 3 most important issues? Answer, passing the child tax credit. That's the kind of thing that could be revolutionary to this country, and we just gave it up. We have to deal with climate change and drought in Arizona. Our future's entirely tied with how we're going to manage this. And immigration reform, we clearly have a refugee and asylum crisis. Question, you have mentioned there were some dark moments after you got back from serving as a Marine in Iraq. Can you tell me about that? By the way, the author of this article is Charlotte Alter. Answer, I was a lot more anxious. I was quick to get angry. You have survivor's guilt. There were times when, instead of dealing with it in a smart, sane way, I decided to drink instead of going to a therapist. Whenever I feel a flare-up coming, I go back to a therapist, but it's never going to ever go away. It is part of my life. Question, what were the most difficult periods? Answer, the breaking point was when my son was coming, because I knew I was going to be a bad father if I did not work on my PTSD. Question, you used to be a strong supporter of Senator Sinema's. What do you anticipate her pushback will be? Answer, nobody trusts her. She has a lot of trust to repair with voters, and she's not going to take the necessary steps to do that. Talking to people that you've pissed off the last 4 years, people you've ignored, people you don't return phone calls from. I've been a big supporter of hers since even before she got to the Senate. There are thousands of people in Arizona that feel that way that are going to have their say. Question, what was your breaking point? Answer, post-January 6, after talking about being friends with John Lewis and John Lewis being her hero, she uses the filibuster to stop the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And then it was other things, whether it was rejecting the $15 per hour minimum wage or negotiating for pharmaceutical companies to keep their pricing, or when she went to the floor to fight for private equity managers and hedge fund managers while the poor in Arizona are hoping to get a child tax credit. Question, so how did you get from there to deciding to challenge her? Answer, knowing Kyrsten and knowing Arizona, I also knew nobody would take her on. In Arizona, she has a reputation for being a very fierce fighter. In order to make change, we have to get her out of the way. Question, why are you challenging Senator Kyrsten Sinema for this Senate seat? Answer, she's abandoned Arizona. We hardly see her anywhere. She does not have an unscripted moment. We see her fighting for pharmaceutical companies, for hedge fund managers. Question, obviously there is going to be a Republican challenger, and Arizona has a lot of independents. What is your strategy to make sure Democrats come out on top? Answer, our first place strategy is to solidify Democrats. There's also a large segment of Latinos that have not been engaged. People are talking about how proud they are that there's a Latino running, and they're proud that it's a Latino that comes from a working class background they actually understand. And I think energizing that young base is going to be extremely important. We are going to be able to attract independents. We are going to energize the Native American vote. We are going to hit every county in Arizona. Question, are you a progressive? Answer, I definitely am in some areas, and in some areas I am in the mainstream norm. I feel like now those labels are just thrown at anything where people just want to say, that person's bad. From the view, the world, Civilization Over Nation by Bruno Macias. Israel is no longer a liberal democracy. As Benjamin Netanyahu's new government took office December 29, its illiberalism was evident. No longer a matter for debate or polite embarrassment, the contempt for liberal ideas brings disparate factions together against the media and intellectuals, and increasingly against the old Western-inspired Israeli political system and constitution. New minister Bezalel Smotrich, for example, calls gay pride parades worse than bestiality, and in 2017 published a political manifesto detailing how best to force Palestinians to truly internalize the loss of national hope, killing those who need to be killed. He was appointed finance minister in Netanyahu's government. Yariv Levin, the new justice minister, proposed January 4 a set of sweeping changes to the powers of the High Court, limiting its ability to strike down legislation, while placing the power to appoint judges in the hands of the executive. None of these developments are unexpected, but there's still a battle to be fought. Will Israel become a nationalist or even theocratic state, excluding everyone who does not accept the oneness of people, land, and religion? Or can the tradition of Jewish values flourish in the context of a civilization state open to other cultures and civilizations? There's a powerful case for a civilization state, but the idea of civilization needs to be distinguished from national or ethnic identity. The latter is irrational and takes pride in accepting race or revelation as a basis for political power. It's defined by opposition to some other group, Jews against Palestinians, whom Smotrich defines as anti-Jews. It ends in bloodshed. Civilization is an exercise in political reason, the effort to organize collective life around principles that express our fundamental relation to truth, to the world, and to each other. The idea of organizing a state around a distinctive civilization is increasingly gaining ground around the world. It corresponds to the crisis of liberalism as a universal program of political and social life. Liberal ideas, for all their intellectual appeal, derived their ultimate force from the economy and military power of the countries, France, Britain, the U.S., where they originated from the 18th century. That power is weakened today. Is this the end of history? Even the dogmas keep changing. Liberal ideas on race and gender, for example, have changed so much during my lifetime, they've become unrecognizable. A renewed competition with rival systems of thought might not be such a bad idea if liberalism is no longer so sure about final truths. As liberal power wanes, rival civilizations are reaffirming themselves as models for how to arrange political and social life. Countries such as Israel and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's India now constitute the best candidates for civilization states and have a renewed claim to be part of the search for the most compelling political beliefs and political system for delivering the good life. Judaism and Hinduism, for example, have for thousands of years developed answers to fundamental political questions on freedom, justice, and equality. It is implausible that nothing on these matters can be learned from those traditions, or that we can place our hopes for political salvation only on Western values. But these countries will fail to become civilization states unless they're able to navigate between the liberalism they no longer accept on one hand and the ethnic or religious nationalism they feel tempted by on the other. The civilization state is a third type beyond both liberalism and nationalism. Why should a Jewish or Hindu civilization state refuse to accept the existence of different traditions and ideas? Why should it demand others accept the loss of hope and happiness? If these civilization states see themselves as superior to liberal ideas, then they must offer better solutions than liberalism has done to the questions of diversity and pluralism. Pandit Dhyandayal Upadhyaya, that's Upadhyaya, who died in 1968, but is one of Modi's main intellectual influences, liked to argue every religion was compatible with Hinduism because the Hindu ideal is a civilization, and a civilization is not related to a mode of worship. He said the Hindu tradition had been open to influences from Islam, so a Muslim could hope to make his own contribution to its growth. A civilization looks up from the world of blood and instinct to the world of light and progress. The challenge today is to turn the revolt against liberalism into a civilizational rather than a national project. The author of this article, Bruno Macias, is author of Geopolitics for the End Time and the forthcoming Masters of the Metaverse. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, What Falling Birth Rates Reveal About China's Future. When China announced in January its population fell in 2022 for the first time since the early 1960s, the search for solutions to a growing demographic crisis took on new urgency. Beijing knew this day was coming, and that an aging population inside a country with a social safety net that remains a work in progress will force new thinking. Failure will stunt the country's economic growth and create social pressures by pushing millions of older people into poverty. That is the backdrop for a decision by authorities in Sichuan province, with a population of more than 80 million, to allow unmarried citizens to register their children and receive state health benefits. So far, only two provinces have taken this road. The municipal government of Shanghai tried this for a few weeks in 2021 before reversing course. But we can expect more Chinese provinces and cities to experiment with similar steps. Yet Chinese officials should know these reforms will not solve China's demographic dilemma. After all, similar plans in Japan and South Korea, which face the same problems, have not had any impact on their own declining birth rates. In all three countries, low salaries, long work hours, and the rising costs of child rearing make large families unaffordable. In Japan, the population began to shrink in 2005. Nearly 29% of Japanese are now 65 or older. And the country's population is forecast to fall from 125 million now to 87 million by 2060. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida warned recently a low birth rate puts Japan on the brink of being unable to maintain social functions. His government will open a new state agency to oversee child care policies, but it's hard to see why that plan can do more than the minister already responsible for this problem. Though South Korea's population did not begin shrinking until 2020, its outlook is even darker than Japan's. According to the OECD, assuming no net migration and unchanged mortality, a total fertility rate of 2.1 children per woman ensures a broadly stable population. South Korea's fertility rate now stands at just 0.8. And the share of its population ages 65 and older is expected to overtake that of Japan by 2045 and will account for half the population by 2070. The efforts of past South Korean governments to throw money at this problem, as Japan and now China have done, have accomplished little, and the country's birth rate is now the lowest in the world. That is why South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, recently fired the vice chair of the Presidential Committee on Birth Rates after she proposed a plan to offer loans of $32,000 to young married couples and forgive the loans after the birth of a second child. Similar financial incentives have failed too many times over too many years. But South Korea has been more aggressive in managing its demographic crisis by moving beyond strategies to increase the birth rate toward plans to welcome a lot more tax-paying immigrants. The country's foreign-born population doubled in just over a decade to push past 2.5 million in 2019. That is still under 5% of the total population, but the number is expected to keep rising. Japan has focused mainly on creating opportunities for higher-skilled foreign workers, and South Korea has promised a fast-track path to citizenship for them. But Seoul has calculated that welcoming larger numbers of immigrants in lower-skilled jobs can help to broaden the tax base more quickly. The lesson for Beijing is clear. It must welcome more foreign workers. That means accepting the risks that come with higher levels of outside influence inside the country, managing the social problems that more immigrants will create, and giving foreigners, high and low skilled, more good reasons to live long term in China. Health Matters by Alice Park, senior health correspondent. The way Americans get vaccinated and boosted against COVID-19 may soon get simpler. January 26, an advisory committee of vaccine experts convened by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, unanimously voted to streamline the current COVID-19 vaccine regimen so the makeup of the primary vaccines matches that of the boosters. Currently, the initial series targets the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, and the recently developed bivalent booster contains both the original and Omicron BA.4/BA.5 variant strains. If the FDA adopts the committee's recommendations, every COVID-19 shot going forward would target the same virus strains. These changes will not take effect just yet. Any shift in the U.S.'s policy would be in coordination with global health groups like the World Health Organization because of how quickly the virus spreads. But the move is a sign that leading health experts are eager to simplify the confusing COVID-19 immunization schedule and better keep up with the constantly evolving virus. If the FDA agrees to the change, the same committee will meet again in June to discuss the details of implementing it. That includes addressing how often people should get immunized and which strains to include in the shots. The committee also supported yearly COVID-19 boosters for most healthy people, similar to the flu shot. Under that plan, the panel would meet annually to determine which strains should be included in the next season's COVID-19 vaccine, and the shot would be tested, produced, and made available by September of each year. Time now for one brief movie review, All That Breathes. After capping off prizes at Sundance and Cannes with an Oscar nomination in January, this gorgeous, profound documentary about two brothers who run a bird hospital in Delhi premiered on HBO February 7. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.